Well, no longer a young girl, Judge, now in her early 20s, had matured and had maintained her respected status as Martha Washington's first attendant. Judge stayed on in the president's house as Washington served his second term, becoming accustomed to her episodic trips back to Mount Vernon. Following the death of her mother and brother, the world she once knew so intimately at Mount Vernon had vanished, perhaps reminding Judge that Mount Vernon was less a home to her than was the North. 7. The Wedding. The enslaved who lived at the executive mansion measured their triumphs in the smallest of ways. Victories were days marked by the First Lady's good mood, and defeat was palpable when the president was angered. For Ona Judge and the other slaves who served the Washingtons, the future was never predictable, and the smallest of matters, such as an accidental overcooking of a meal or antagonistic political news, could change the mood of their owners with the snap of a finger. By his peers, the president was not considered a violent slave owner, but all of the slaves who worked for him in Philadelphia and at Mount Vernon knew that on occasion he did lose his temper. And in February 1796, a letter arrived that prompted everyone, slave and servant, black and white, to tread lightly around George and Martha Washington. The president and the first lady enjoyed the correspondence they received from Virginia, especially the letters written by close family and friends. The stories and reports that arrived via the mail were reminiscent of a simpler life at Mount Vernon, and sometimes they remedied Martha Washington's homesickness. However, the post could also bring the most dreadful news, such as death announcements or descriptions of poor tobacco harvests. When the president opened a letter from his step-granddaughter, he wished for good news, but he was disappointed. 19-year-old Elizabeth Park Custis, called Betsy by her family and Eliza by her adult friends, lived in Virginia. She had news to share, urgent news, that needed swift attention from her grandparents. Without their knowledge, Eliza had taken a suitor, and much to the surprise of everyone, the relationship quickly turned serious. The unknown boyfriend was named Thomas Law, a British businessman who had immigrated to America in 1794, and in a short period of time he had become heavily involved in land development in and around the federal city. There was a lot of money to be made around the future site of the nation's capital, and Law was determined to get in on the ground floor of land speculation and construction. He had lived in India for quite some time, serving as a policymaker on behalf of the British government. And now, Thomas Law found himself in the most peculiar of positions in his new country. He had fallen in love with the president's granddaughter, a woman who was 20 years his junior. Thomas Law and Eliza Custis promised themselves to one another, but they both knew that their union would need to be approved by the most powerful man in the new nation. Though she initially concealed the relationship from her grandparents, Eliza now turned to them for support, asking the president to give the news of her engagement careful consideration before rushing to judgment. She also asked the president to wait until he had heard from her intended before he made a decision. Eliza knew that her grandparents, especially her grandmother, would be uneasy with this news. Ona Judge witnessed deep concern envelop the First Lady, an unsurprising response for a woman who had outlived all of her children. For Martha Washington, her grandchildren were the only remaining connections to her deceased heirs. Two of her babies, Daniel and Francis, from her marriage with Daniel Park Custis, had been snatched by death's indiscriminate hand before they reached their fifth birthdays. Young Patsy's seizure had extinguished her life at the age of 17, and her brother John would succumb to illness at the age of 27. Martha Washington was middle-aged with no living children, so she turned all of her attention and care toward her grandchildren Nellie, Washie, Eliza, and Martha, called Patsy by her friends. George and Martha Washington's marriage, never yielded children. Although Martha Washington was only 27 years old when she married the president, she was 8 months older than George. She never bore him a child. This must have been a disappointment to the couple, especially for the president. But they would eventually receive an opportunity to share the experience of child-rearing. After the death of Martha's only surviving son, John, affectionately called Jackie, Martha and George Washington welcomed two of his small children into their home. The president and the first lady became the caregivers for Nellie and little Washy Park Custis, while older siblings Eliza and Patsy remained with their mother in Virginia. Martha Washington was committed to the lives of all four of her Park Custis heirs. Now, one of her grandchildren had made a monumental, life-changing decision, pending Washington's approval, and there was much to be concerned about. Thomas Law arrived in America with two of his three children, both of whom were the offspring from a relationship with an Indian woman. His biracial children and his age most certainly raised concerns for the Washingtons. However, it was his British citizenship that gave Martha and George Washington reason to pause. Would their dear Betsy be taken away to a foreign country with her new spouse, or would Law agree to remain in America? Tension filled the rooms of the executive mansion. Although this was family business, everyone who lived within the walls of the president's house knew exactly what was happening, including Ona Judge, who was, in some measure, responsible for her mistress's happiness. Judge would have worked with care and caution as she tended to the needs of Martha Washington. The first lady had been busy with preparations for the upcoming birthnight ball in honor of the president's 64th birthday, and was completely unprepared to deal with her granddaughter's explosive announcement. Judge was accustomed to watching tense situations unfold in the president's house, so she did what she was trained to do, be attentive, say little, but hear everything. 3 days later, George Washington received a letter from Thomas Law announcing his intentions of marrying Eliza and undoubtedly asking for approval and a blessing. The president and Mrs. Washington discussed the situation, and as the snow began to fall, the president sat down to write both his granddaughter and Thomas Law. In his letter to Eliza, dated February 10, 1796, Washington acknowledged that he had obeyed his granddaughter's request. He had not responded to her letter until he heard from her intended. He asked Eliza if she was certain that Law was the man of her choice. The president wrote, "If Mr. Law is the man of your choice, of which there can be no doubt, as he has merits to engage your affections, and you have declared that he has not only done so, but that you find, after a careful examination of your heart, you cannot be happy without him, that your alliance with him meets my approbation. Yes, Betsy, and this approbation is accompanied with my fervent wishes that you may be as happy in this important event as your most sanguine imagination has ever presented to your view." Responding to Thomas Law's letter with a cool hint of annoyance, Washington made clear that the intended union between Law and his granddaughter was a complete surprise. But the president did nonetheless offer the approval of both grandparents, adding that he offered best wishes that both of you may be supremely happy in the alliance. He closed by emphasizing his family's desire that Eliza stay stateside, saying, "We shall hope that your fortunes, if not before, will, by this event, be fixed in America, for it would be a heart-rending circumstance if you should separate, sick, Eliza from her friends in this country." The president's not too subtle suggestion that Law remain in America with his granddaughter was followed by an invitation for a visit at the executive mansion. The years that Martha Washington spent as First Lady taught her the art of public appearance. She refused to make her concerns public knowledge, and instead acted as though she could not have been more pleased about her granddaughter's impending marriage. The First Lady told all who would listen about the upcoming wedding, pretending to be a proud and excited grandmother. It was clear, however, that the Washington's inner circle of friends and family viewed the upcoming nuptials as anything but normal. The tongues of political insiders began to wag, and even ally and Vice President John Adams contributed to the presidential gossip when he wrote to his wife Abigail, "I have a great deal of news to tell you. Mrs. Washington told me the last time I dined at the president's that Betsy Custis is to be married next month to Mr. Law, the English East India Nabob. The good lady is as gay as a girl and tells the story in a very humorous style. Mr. Law says he's only 35 years of age, and although the climate of India has given him an older look, yet his constitution is not impaired beyond his years. He has asked leave and a blessing of the President and Mrs. W. He is to finish a house in the federal city and live there. He has two children born in India, but of whom is not explained." As politicians and acquaintances talked about the president's granddaughter, Martha Washington went from concealing her concerns to making peace with the worrisome union. Always the protective grandmother, she diminished the irregularity of Eliza's marriage through humor and cheerful conversation as she entertained friends and dignitaries at Washington's birthday celebration. Yet behind her forced smiles and merriment, Martha Washington was devising a plan for her granddaughter's future, plans that would upend Judge's life. Eliza's engagement distracted George Washington from his own concerns, the disappointment he was sure to provoke when he announced his future plans. He had been wrestling with the question of whether or not to run for a third term in office, and early in 1796, against the strong desires of many, the president decided to retire from public life and began to prepare a farewell address to the American people. With the decision settled, Martha knew that it would be but a short matter of time before she found herself back in Virginia, connected to her friends and family, perhaps helping Eliza navigate married life. Judge most certainly knew that her time in Philadelphia was therefore limited too. By the time of the wedding of Eliza Custis, which took place on March 21, 1796, in Virginia at Hope Park, an estate built by Eliza's stepfather, Dr. David Stewart. The news that Washington would retire from office was no longer a secret among family members. The slaves living at the executive mansion would have understood that their time in Philadelphia was drawing to a close. Judge thought long and hard about her 7-year residency in the North, and the thought of returning to Mount Vernon was not an easy sell. Indeed, Judge had no real desire to return to Virginia, nor did she possess strong feelings of attachment to Mount Vernon. Was this not the time for Ona Judge to seize the day, leave the Washingtons, and never look back? Could she find the bravery, the grit, and the power to leave everyone and everything that she knew? Several factors influenced her decision and tipped the balance sheet in one direction over the other. Judge's biggest concern would have been the likelihood of never seeing her extended family at Mount Vernon again. Her living siblings remained at Mount Vernon with the expectation of being reunited one day with their sister. Philadelphia and Betty Davis continued in the tradition of their mother and spent their day sewing for the Washingtons, but the welfare of Betty Davis probably weighed on Judge's mind. She knew that Philadelphia was at the Mansion House, but Betty Davis moved around a bit more. Davis spent time at both the Mansion House and Dogue Run, another farm on the Mount Vernon estate. She had tested the patience of her owners on a couple of occasions, so that by 1795, Washington wrote about her with animosity. He simply disliked Davis. The president had grown tired of the excuses, the obstinacy, and the laziness that Davis openly displayed. Many slaveholders would never tolerate such behavior and used violent punishment or the threat of sale to cure disobedience. The president cautioned his farm manager, William Pierce, to keep a close eye on her, believing that she would use any excuse to avoid working. Washington wrote, "If pretended ailments without apparent causes or visible effects will screen her from work, I shall get no service at all from her, for a more lazy, deceitful, and impudent hussy is not to be found in the United States." The likelihood of Betty Davis fetching a high price at auction was relatively high, as she was only 25 years old and still considered reproductively fit. Judge no doubt knew some, if not all, of this, and worried about her sister. On the other hand, was the question of Ona Judge's future once she returned to Virginia after the retirement of the president. Her duties were likely to change once she returned to Mount Vernon, and might include new tasks, ones that were more physically taxing and required for rural Southern living. Judge also understood that the small amounts of private time she enjoyed in the North would be hard to come by in Virginia. While in Philadelphia, the Washington social calendar was filled with dinners and social gatherings, events that allowed Judge moments of stolen privacy where she could sew, talk with house slaves and staff, take a trip to the theater, or simply rest. This life, as she knew it, would come to an end once she returned to Virginia. None of the slaves at the president's house knew what the future held. For Ona Judge, however, the uncertainty vanished with a startling piece of news. The marriage of Eliza Law was to cut her post in Philadelphia short. Those who served the president in Philadelphia were likely to return from the traditional summer family trip to Mount Vernon, all of them except Ona. Her time in Philadelphia appeared as though it had come to a close. Martha Washington knew that her granddaughter was completely unprepared for her new marriage with Thomas Law. She understood that Eliza knew nothing about the duties that accompanied a new marriage, let alone about setting up a new household in the federal city. In an effort to help Eliza ease into her new matrimony, Martha Washington stepped in and offered Eliza the support she needed. She would bequeath Judge to Eliza Law as a wedding gift. If Judge ever believed that her close and intimate responsibilities for her owner yielded preferential treatment, she now understood better. The bondwoman now knew for certain that in the eyes of her owner she was replaceable, just like any of the hundreds of slaves who toiled for the Washingtons. Judge may have overheard a conversation between Mrs. Washington and Eliza Law, or maybe Mrs. Washington simply mentioned the news in passing to her slave. No matter how the information was conveyed, Judge learned that she would eventually be given to the newlywed. Every slave understood that the death of a master signaled a change in ownership, so Judge knew that one day she would no longer serve the Washingtons. But it was Eliza Law's wedding that made Judge realize that her departure from Mount Vernon might come sooner than she ever imagined, a prospect that gravely concerned her. The bondwoman knew that nothing would change the First Lady's mind. Even though Judge had claimed one of the most revered positions within the executive mansion, she would always be a slave, and her feelings did not matter to Martha Washington or to anyone else in power. Surprise gave way to anger, which quickly turned to fear. The pangs of anxiety she felt were based not only on having to leave Philadelphia, but also on having to work for and with Eliza Custis Law, a young woman with a stormy reputation. All who were acquainted with the president's granddaughter commented upon her stubbornness and complete disregard for protocol. Eliza was unlike many elite 18th century women in that she was assertive and refused to shrink from male authority. Family members joked that in her tastes and pastimes, she is more man than woman and regrets that she can't wear pants. Eliza did what she wanted to do, often appearing irritated and labile. On occasion, she refused to go to church and other obligatory social functions, and her quick engagement to Thomas Law was a reminder to everyone that Eliza would be the architect of her own life. George Washington often found Eliza's antics amusing, but the enslaved men and women who served Eliza would have found her temperament difficult at best. There is no question that Ona Judge would have had plentiful interaction with her as she assisted Eliza during her visits to the executive mansion, most certainly experiencing the wrath of her mercurial granddaughter. Although human bondage was horrific under any owner, there was always room for slaves to make comparisons. George and Martha Washington were not known for flying into unprovoked rages and were relatively stable and predictable owners. For Judge, a shift to the irritable and volcanic Eliza Custis Law could doom her to a life of poor treatment. Ona Judge would have also worried about the newest member of the Washington family, a man with a shadowy reputation. Thomas Law grew his fortune in India before arriving in the District of Columbia. The land speculator purchased close to 500 lots around the new city, expecting to line his pockets with cash once the nation's capital moved south. While his quick engagement to the president's granddaughter painted him as an opportunist, Judge would have worried more about his principles and behavior, especially given his sketchy familial past. The new member of the family had arrived in America with two of his three sons, both illegitimate and both the children of an Indian woman. While there were many biracial children at Mount Vernon, Judge herself was one of them. Law's children spoke to every slave woman's fear. Thomas Law slept with non-white women and wasn't concerned about the gossip. Judge must have worried that she might be the next target of Thomas Law's sexual interest. She was young, attractive, and would now be a slave working within his household. It would be nearly impossible to avoid his advances, a reality of female enslavement that stoked the fears of young girls and women alike. Rape and forced breeding torturously enlarged the institution of slavery, reminding every enslaved woman that she was never safe from sexual attack. The mothers, aunts, and sisters of young girls warned their female kinfolk about the sexual dangers that came with enslavement. Knowledge of what might happen to their growing prepubescent bodies prepared them for a vulnerable future. Author and fugitive slave Harriet Jacobs knew this vulnerability too well and described her encounters with her new owner. No matter whether the slave girl be as black as ebony or as fair as her mistress, in either case, there is no shadow of law to protect her from insult, from violence, or even from death. All of these are inflicted by fiends who bear the shape of men. For a young woman such as Judge, the dangers of the unfamiliar, Eliza's temper and Law's sexual profile, served as an urgent incentive to run away. Living in Philadelphia exposed Judge to the benefits not only of owning one's own labor, but of also being able to select a mate, to have the relationship sanctioned by law, and to bear children who did not belong to a white master. The Washington's granddaughter was now married and on her way to motherhood. A legal marriage would be a near impossibility for Judge if she was given to Mrs. Law. Martha Washington's decision to turn Judge over to Eliza was a reminder to Judge and to everyone enslaved at the executive mansion that they had absolutely no control over their lives, no matter how loyally they served. Slaves all over the young nation always dreamed and wished for emancipation. But Judge didn't need to imagine anything. In Philadelphia, she could see freedom, feel freedom, and experience freedom in the smallest of ways. Judge's time spent in the North, along with her pending return down south and a belief that she might never return, forced her to think deeply about her future. 8. The Fugitive. $10 reward. Absconded from the household of the President of the United States on Saturday afternoon, Oney Judge, a light mulatto girl, much freckled, with very black eyes and bushy black hair. She is of middle stature, but slender and delicately made, about 20 years of age. She has many changes of very good clothes of all sorts, but they are not sufficiently recollected to describe. As there was no suspicion of her going off, and it happened without the least provocation, it is not easy to conjecture whether she is gone or fully what her design is. But as she may attempt to escape by water, all matters of vessels and others are cautioned against receiving her on board, although she may, and probably will, endeavor to pass for a free woman, and it is said has wherewithal to pay her passage. $10 will be paid to any person, white or black, who will bring her home, if taken in the city or on board any vessel in the harbor, and a further reasonable sum if apprehended and brought home from a greater distance, and in proportion to the distance. During the spring months of 1796, Ona Judge's mind was filled with dreams, nightmares, plans, and challenges. Focusing on her normal tasks would have been difficult, but still a requirement. As she brushed Martha Washington's hair before bedtime, she was careful not to tug too hard on the aging First Lady's scalp. Women in their mid-60s lamented hair loss, so Judge was gentle with each stroke of the brush. But her mind wandered. Judge's concerns about returning to Virginia and becoming the property of Eliza Law were all-consuming, and at the very least, distracting. As the household slaves and servants began to prepare for the trip back to Mount Vernon, Judge continued to be deferential and obedient on the outside, while on the inside, she grew more anxious. Each night, as Judge removed the stains from Mrs. Washington's dresses and scraped the mud and dirt off the First Lady's shoes, she contemplated the forbidden and thought seriously about reaching out for help. Yet she was frightened, and the mere mention of the words fugitive or runaway disrupted the rhythm of Judge's heartbeat. She remembered when the Washingtons first arrived in Philadelphia and heard talk about a growing fugitive slave problem. Although New York and New Jersey dragged their feet in statewide abolition, slaves in the Mid-Atlantic and the Upper South knew that freedom could be found in the towns and cities of the North, as nearly all states north of Pennsylvania had already passed some kind of gradual abolition law. Numerous hurdles stood in the way of the brave enslaved men and women who dared to leave the small farms or shops of their masters. Judge undoubtedly saw these fugitives in the streets of the new capital, and although these men and women tried desperately to hide their pasts, a southern accent, or recognition by a former owner's acquaintance could easily betray them. Judge had heard the stories of just how difficult it was to run away from an owner. One of the first obstacles for fugitive slaves to confront was the issue of northern climates. The weather in cities such as Philadelphia up to the small towns of New England fluctuated constantly, and brutal northeastern winters prompted slaves to consider spring or summer escapes. 2 or 3 months out of every year, the Delaware River froze over, eliminating the sea as an escape route. The small rivers and creeks across the north were also impassable, often sending brave and desperate fugitives to premature, icy deaths. Roads, impassable from heavy snow and frozen mud, disabled even the strongest and most agile fugitives, trapping men and women on the run. Many lost their lives to hypothermia as they hid in the caves, barns, and alleyways of the north, with little to no food or a proper winter coat or shoes. Empty stomachs steered fugitives to search for food, but the winter months drove vegetables and fruits into hibernation. Fishing and hunting proved extremely difficult in heavy snow and ice, prompting men and women on the run to steal small animals from nearby farms. This always proved a desperate act and could end a fugitive's race to freedom, as farmers would notice a missing calf or chicken. Ona Judge was contemplating escape in the spring or early summer season which also had its challenges. Relentless heat and humidity could send the fugitive to an early grave, as heat stroke prompted vomiting and serious confusion. Dehydration transformed already tired bodies with sunken eyes into unmovable masses, as the healthiest of fugitives could only last 3 to 5 days without access to water. Spring and summer rains transformed dirt roads into muddy swamps, simultaneously claiming lives via mudslides. Of course, high illiteracy rates made it almost impossible for most fugitives to read poorly marked signs or directions. Even if given a map, Ona Judge would not have been able to read it. Years before the safe houses of the Underground Railroad saved the lives of men and women on the run, most fugitives had few options for shelter and protection. The forests and wilderness protected escaped slaves from the eyes of local citizens, and thick brush and dense forest beds provided secrecy, as did abandoned cabins and stone hollows. Beyond the weather and difficult conditions, Judge likely contemplated just how few women made successful attempts at escape. Unlike Judge, the majority of fugitives, 90% from Pennsylvania down to Virginia, were male. The same held true for South Carolina and parts of the Upper South. There were many reasons for the extremely low number of female escapees, but historians have focused on the relationships between mothers and children as the main deterrent for female slaves. Throughout the rural South, enslaved children were much more likely to live with their mothers than with their fathers. Abroad marriages, relationships between enslaved men and women who lived on different properties, often placed miles between husbands and wives. The inability to form legal marriages and the indiscriminate sale of human property often tore children from their fathers, sometimes separating young slaves from their fathers forever. Most fugitives were between the ages of 16 and 35 years old, the exact age span when enslaved women tended to be pregnant, nursing, or caring for a child. Enslaved mothers worried about all those who were left behind, fearing that retribution from a scorned owner would show itself on the backs of their children. This fear, of course, tethered slave mothers to the homes and estates of their owners. Successful escapes with children in tow were extremely difficult, as long-distance travel with infants and toddlers reduced the chances of success. Children's cries of hunger and fatigue were easily detectable in dark forests and cold caves. Unable to walk or move quickly, small children slowed the tempo of the run to freedom. It was hard enough for a healthy adult to escape his owner, but for women with children, the task was near impossible. Childless, Judge would not have to confront the horror of leaving one's children behind for the opportunity of freedom. Of course, if she made the decision to escape, she would cut ties from her family back at Mount Vernon, a terrible choice to consider, but one that was altogether different from leaving behind a baby. Runaway slave advertisements appeared frequently in Ben Franklin's Pennsylvania Gazette, and, not surprisingly, most of them sought the return of male slaves. The number of runaway ads increased over the colonial period, and by the time Ona Judge arrived in Philadelphia, an average of 26 advertisements appeared in the Gazette every year. Slave women who appeared in the ads were runaways from Philadelphia proper and the surrounding counties. In September of 1790, a runaway ad appeared in the Gazette for a slave woman named Kate. Taking advantage of the tail end of the summer, Kate ran away from her master on the night of August 23rd. The 21-year-old fugitive left her Chester County home and supposedly went off with a black man named Charles. A $4 reward was offered for the mulatto girl, who took with her an old black bonnet, a long gown striped red, blue, and white, 2 short ditto striped blue, red, and white, and a large white shawl. A month later, an advertisement for a 35-year-old slave woman named Nancy appeared in the Gazette. An $8 reward was posted for the fugitive woman, who was described as of a black cast, but not the very blackest, who was country-born and understands farmers' kitchen work very well. The newspaper ads served as a reminder to both enslaved and free black Philadelphians that freedom was elusive. Although emancipation had come to many blacks in the city, it was still beyond the grasp of the enslaved in the surrounding counties. Even though Ona Judge was unable to read the newspaper ads on her own, the president's slaves were almost all kept illiterate. An oral tradition quickly moved this kind of information through black communities and to eager listeners. Successful escapes offered hope to those who remained in bondage, and failed attempts remind them of the serious consequences that came with failure. Slaves were often whipped or beaten for running away, sometimes in the presence of kinfolk and other slaves on the small farm or large estate from which they ran. Washington remained vigilant about any and all escape attempts from Mount Vernon, even while he was living in Philadelphia. Although the president reportedly avoided the tearing apart of slave families, he was not averse to punishing or selling difficult slaves when he deemed appropriate. During the early 1790s, Washington sold at least two difficult slaves to the Caribbean after their maddening defiance could not be controlled. Washington threatened a slave named Ben that he would no longer tolerate disobedience and that if a stop is not put to his rogueries and other villainies by fair means and shortly, that I will ship him off, as I did Wagoner Jack, for the West Indies, sick, where he will have no opportunity of playing such pranks as he is at present engaged in. In 1791, the enslaved Wagoner Jack was sold for a quantity of wine. Aside from knowing that her master was not beyond selling a slave for serious infractions of the rules, Judge also understood that the slaves of Mount Vernon were subjected to physical violence. In January of 1793, Washington condoned the whipping of Judge's sister-in-law, Charlotte. Mount Vernon estate manager Anthony Whiting wrote to the president about a disobedient seamstress and recounted Charlotte's constant insubordination. Whiting wrote that he gave a very good whipping, and his plans for continued physical violence were made clear when he stated that he was determined to lower her spirit or skin her back. Washington responded to Whiting, stating, "And if she, or any other of the servants, will not do their duty by fair means, or are impertinent, correction, as the only alternative, must be administered." The month following Charlotte's brutal whipping, and with Haitian slave insurrection on the minds of many, Washington set out to ease some of the concerns of Southern slaveholders. A little more than 2 years into his residency in Philadelphia, the president signed into law the Fugitive Slave Act, creating a legal mechanism for the capturing and reclaiming of fugitive slaves. According to this act, signed in February 1793, a slave owner or his agent could legally seize a runaway and force the apprehended slave to appear in front of a judge or magistrate in the locality where he or she was captured. After written or oral proof of ownership was presented by the slaveholder, a judge could order the return of the alleged fugitive. The controversial law also stated that any person who shall knowingly and willingly obstruct or hinder such claimant, his agent or attorney, in so seizing or arresting such fugitive from labor, or shall rescue such fugitive from such claimant, his agent or attorney, when so arrested, pursuant to the authority herein given and declared, or shall harbor or conceal such person after notice that he or she was a fugitive from labor, as aforesaid, shall, for either of the said offenses, forfeit and pay the sum of $500, which penalty may be recovered by and for the benefit of such claimant, by action of debt, in any court proper to try the same, saving, moreover, to the person claiming such labor or service, his right of action for or on account of the said injuries, or either of them. To be clear, those who purposely interfered with the recapturing of a slave or who offered aid or assistance to a fugitive could be fined an exorbitant amount, $500, imprisoned, and be sued by the slaveholder in question. Southerners rejoiced over the new law, considering it a legal triumph to pursue their human property across state lines. However, for northern states that no longer enforced or practiced human bondage, the law was a reminder of the growing divide over the issue of slavery. Northern states had no choice but to accept federal intervention regarding fugitive slaves. But it is important to note that Congress did not pass the Fugitive Slave Act with a unanimous voice. Arguing that the Fugitive Slave Law of 1793 was unconstitutional, northern states believed that the law erased the states' rights to legislate the contested issues surrounding fugitive slaves. Shortly after the act was passed, many of the northern states passed personal liberty laws, requiring trial by jury for blacks accused of being fugitive slaves. Several northern states also used personal liberty laws to make certain that the recapture of a fugitive slave could be viewed as a kidnapping offense if not done through appropriate measures. Southern states, on the other hand, argued that the Fugitive Slave Law protected their property rights and that the law was imperative to carry out the Constitution's provisions regarding fugitives from labor. Just as the slaves on High Street knew about gradual emancipation in Pennsylvania, they most certainly learned about the new federal law that made escape even more improbable. Without question, then, Ona Judge knew that the consequences of running away would be steep, so her escape had to be successful. If she ran away and was captured, her life would change instantly, as angry owners might punish her in the worst way imaginable, by placing her on the auction block and selling her to the highest bidder. The Washingtons might do what they had done before. They might put her in their pocket. She had examined the facts, the mercurial Eliza, the biases against blacks, the treatment of blacks in the aftermath of the yellow fever epidemic, the danger of the fugitive slave law, and Judge realized that if she ran away, she couldn't plan her escape alone. So she took the biggest of gambles and confided in a group of crucial associates, free black allies. We do not know how Ona Judge made contact with the group of free blacks who would offer to help with an escape. Perhaps while escorting Martha Washington to one of her many social calls, she took the opportunity to ask for assistance. As her mistress enjoyed afternoon tea, Judge could have reached out to a free black servant, one who might know how to help her, or at least could discreetly point her in the direction of someone else who could. Every black Philadelphian knew that there was one man who could and did help runaways, the well-known preacher Richard Allen. As one of the most influential leaders of the early Republic, Reverend Richard Allen is often given credit for building the free black community of Philadelphia. By the 1790s, Allen simultaneously served as a spiritual leader to a growing black community and was also an entrepreneur, owning and operating a chimney sweep business. His trade was dangerous, but one of the few entrepreneurial opportunities open to black men. In a short time, Allen was able to hire apprentices to help grow his business and soon climbed up the economic ladder. Perhaps the most important person on Allen's client list was the president himself, and we know that Allen collected money from the executive mansion for his services in March of 1796. Perhaps, after talking with a trusted friend, Judge reached out to Allen during his visit to the president's house. Her words and interactions with the preacher would have gone undetectable by the House staff, and, in a whisper, she would have asked Allen for help. Quick words would have passed between the two, perhaps with a plan to meet somewhere else to discuss her chances for finding freedom. Allen would have been a natural person to consult about the best way to flee the city and remain undetected. although Judge never publicly admitted to receiving help from Allen. Their paths may have crossed a second time during the spring of 1796. The well-known minister included on his impressive resume the skills of a cobbler and was eventually listed on the Philadelphia tax rolls as operating a shoe shop in his home on Spruce Street. On May 10th, the Washingtons gave Judge $1.25 to purchase new shoes, money that she could have taken directly to the shoe shop in Allen's home. There, Judge would have had more time and privacy to discuss the possibilities of escape with the famed black leader, who was himself an ex-slave. She never revealed the identity of her friends who helped her to think about the possibilities of escape, as aiding a fugitive slave was considered a federal crime up until the Civil War. Judge knew what the future held should she not heed the advice of her free black associates. She supposed if she went back to Virginia, she should never have a chance to escape. Once she learned that, upon the decease of her master and mistress, she would become the property of a granddaughter of theirs by the name of Custis, she knew that she had to flee. She imagined that her work for the laws would begin immediately, not after the death of her owners, prompting a fierce clarity about her future and her dislike for Eliza Custis. She was determined never to be her slave. Her decision was made. She would risk everything to avoid the clutches of the new Mrs. Law. Judge was well informed and knew that her decision to flee was far more than risky. But still, she was willing to face dog-sniffing kidnappers and bounty hunters for the rest of her life. Yes, her fear was consuming, but so too was her anger. Judge could no longer stomach her enslavement, and it was the change in her ownership that pulled the trigger on Judge's fury. She had given everything to the Washingtons. For 12 years, she had served her mistress faithfully, and now she was to be discarded like the scraps of material that she cut from Martha Washington's dresses. Any false illusions she had clung to had evaporated, and Judge knew that no matter how obedient or loyal she may have appeared to her owners, she would never be considered fully human. Her fidelity meant nothing to the Washingtons. She was their property, to be sold, mortgaged, or traded with whomever they wished. The beast that slept in every slave's soul was awakened. Confronting a future with Eliza Law coaxed the hunger for freedom out of the recesses of Judge's mind, and now she was willing to fight for what she clearly believed was her right. Her decision to run was just the beginning of her liberation. The waiting was difficult. For nearly 2 weeks, Judge had to calm her nerves and suppress her anger as allies completed the planning for her escape. She could not raise suspicions, so Judge worked in tandem with the rest of the household as they made the necessary preparations for a lengthy trip back to Mount Vernon. Judge later stated, "Whilst they were packing up to go to Virginia, I was packing to go. I didn't know where, for I knew that if I went back to Virginia, I should never get my liberty." Judge kept her plans a secret, making certain not to share information with anyone who lived in the executive mansion. She knew that fearful or jealous slaves were often responsible for foiled fugitive escapes. She decided to rely only on the assistance of free blacks who resided outside the walls of the president's home. Not only did Ona Judge have to pack her things to leave, she also had to determine when she would escape. Although the executive mansion possessed more slaves and servants than did most northern residences, Judge was the first lady's preferred house slave and had to be available at all times for whatever reason. There was only one duty from which she was exempt: meal preparation. The famed Hercules and a kitchen staff prepared all the meals served to the president and the first family. Judge sometimes received a bit of free time during the afternoon meal and the evening supper, as other servants or slaves were assigned to serve the Washingtons. The president often entertained dinner guests, extending the festivities into the evening and inviting guests to retire to the parlor to enjoy a bit of wine and additional conversation. This would be the only moment that Judge could use to her advantage. And when the moment arrived, she gathered her steely nerves and fled. On Saturday, May 21st, 1796, Ona Judge slipped out of the executive mansion while the Washingtons ate their supper. She disappeared into the free black community of Philadelphia. No one knows exactly when Martha Washington realized that her prized slave was missing. Perhaps dinner ran well into the evening, and Judge's absence went unnoticed until late that night. Or maybe the president and his wife uncovered her escape just minutes after Judge left the executive mansion. The details may never be uncovered, but once the Washingtons realized that Judge was gone, they quickly understood that it was highly unlikely that she possessed any intention of returning. Washington was accustomed to slaves running away from Mount Vernon. On occasion, they would return after several days or weeks, but unlike past attempts made by fugitives, Judge's starting point was in the north, and the Washingtons knew time wasn't on their side. On May 23, 1796, just 2 days later, Frederick Kitt, the steward for the executive mansion, placed an ad in the Philadelphia Gazette acknowledging the disappearance of Ona Judge. He placed another ad in Claypool's American Daily Advertiser the next day with additional details about the escape. The language of the runaway ad was similar to others that appeared in 18th century newspapers, describing Ona Judge while simultaneously announcing that she had defied the president. Absconded from the household of the President of the United States on Saturday afternoon, Ona Judge, a light mulatto girl, much freckled, with very black eyes and bushy black hair. She is of middle stature, but slender, and delicately made, about 20 years of age. Judge's runaway ad went on to describe the possessions that she had packed up. The ad noted that Judge had many changes of very good clothes of all sorts, but they are not sufficiently recollected to describe. Frederick Kitt's ads alerted shadowy slave catchers to Judge's possible escape route, the Delaware River. The advertisement warned all who worked on the docks of Philadelphia's busy port that the runaway would take to the open seas. But as she may attempt to escape by water, all manners of vessels are cautioned against admitting her into them, although it is probable she will attempt to pass for a free woman, and has, it is said, wherewithal to pay her passage. A $10 reward, the cost of a barrel of flour, was offered for Judge's return, a typical amount proposed by slaveholders trying to reclaim their property. However, wanting to ensure a successful outcome, Judge's owners offered the reward to anyone who turned her in, no matter their race. Kitt's second and subsequent ads for Judge's return stated, $10 will be paid to any person, white or black, who will bring her home, if taken in the city or on board any vessel in the harbor. Judge knew that the moment she walked out of the president's mansion, she would become a hunted woman. She would transform from a trusted house slave for the most powerful American family to a criminal guilty of stealing her own body away from her owners. Now she had to leave the city of Philadelphia as fast as possible and search for an environment in which she would be safe from the president's grasp. Although a few scholars suggest that Judge may have spent some time hiding among the free black community of Philadelphia, it is highly unlikely. This was a formidable task, as federal law made every state in the nation a danger zone for fugitives. Word spread about the runaway slave woman, and reports of supposed sightings trickled back to the president quickly. On June 28th, trusted friend Thomas Lee Jr. wrote to Washington about his female fugitive. Apparently, the president had asked his friend to inquire about Judge in and around New York, Lee obliged him, and after a bit of investigation, discovered that the escapee had indeed made her way to New York. According to Lee, a free mulatto woman, who served as a cook in one of New York's numerous boarding houses, reported that she is well acquainted, sick, with Oni, and that she has been here, and was supposedly headed to Boston. But Lee didn't trust her claim. The free woman might have been trying to lead Lee down an errant path with false information. Or maybe she was simply mistaken and was confusing Judge for someone else. Thomas Lee may not have been certain about the supposed sighting of Judge, but he took no chances and notified law enforcement authorities in New York about the possibility of the fugitive's presence anyway. Judge would have been warned against spending any time in New York, the place she once called home and where she was recognizable. Free blacks in Philadelphia would have urged her to flee with the most urgent speed and to make no stops along the way to her final destination. Harboring a fugitive was punishable by a fine and/or imprisonment, and to assist the president's slave in her escape would have been even more dangerous. Those who aided Judge pushed for an expeditious departure, knowing the president was prepared to use all of his immense power to recapture his property. Judge needed to leave Philadelphia as fast as possible and look to the wharves of the Delaware River to make her escape. In fact, Judge escaped the city by boat. In her 1845 interview, Judge told of her journey to Portsmouth, New Hampshire, on a vessel that was commanded by Captain John Bowles. Judge remained secretive about her escape almost her whole life, only announcing the name of the captain more than a decade after his death, in July of 1837. "I never told his name till after he died, a few years since, lest they should punish him for bringing me away." Ona Judge knew that she owed her life to Bowles. Like many other 18th-century sailors, John Bowles operated a shipping business with a partner, Thomas Lee. The two ran their freight business along the eastern coast, transporting lumber and fish to the port cities of New York and Philadelphia. They sold their items at market and returned with leather goods, such as boots, bridles, and saddles, to sell in New Hampshire's seaport town. Bowles knew the Atlantic well. He most likely began his relationship with the sea as an apprenticed deckhand, quickly moving up the ranks and eventually commanding his own ship, the Nancy. For many years, he conducted his business up and down the North Atlantic coast, traveling to the Caribbean and back until the English Navy captured his ship in 1800. In 1796, Bowles was still very active, however. The local Portsmouth newspaper, Oracle of the Day, reported the departures and arrivals of ships and announced the items that would be exported and imported. The Portsmouth Customs House cleared the Nancy's voyage to Philadelphia in early May of 1796. Bowles most likely left the Portsmouth Harbor and sailed directly to Philadelphia, a trip that would have taken 4 to 5 days, weather permitting. The Philadelphia Gazette announced Bowles's arrival in the city on May 10th, and while docked in Philadelphia, Bowles advertised his wares for sale, as well as reasonably priced freight and passenger rates. The captain lingered in the Philadelphia port, perhaps looking to pick up additional passengers or to sell as much of his cargo as possible. Ona Judge eventually boarded Bowles's ship, a sloop that carried molasses, coffee, potatoes, leather goods, and candles. The Nancy slipped out of Philadelphia sometime after Saturday, May 21st. If Bowles charged her, she would have paid for it either out of the money shared from the gifts the Washingtons doled out, a dollar here and a dollar there, or she was assisted by the free black community, who most likely steered Judge toward Bowles and may have aided with her fare. The commander of the Nancy was not publicly known for his anti-slavery sentiment, but he must have been a relatively safe bet and not known as hostile to runaways. Judge's fair skin, her clothing, and perhaps her demeanor may have led Bowles to assume that his passenger was a free woman instead of a hunted slave. But while her appearance may not have alerted bulls, traveling alone as a young woman would have caused most people to raise an eyebrow. In the 1790s, few women, black or white, traveled unaccompanied, as the social